It's really nice to see you. Welcome. We're on our, it's like an extra class for this course, How Buddhism Helps. Normally the How Buddhism Helps course is over 3 weeks because it's based on the three principal aspects of the path. So we'd spend 1 week on each one. But we had an extra week up our sleeve. So I thought I'd kind of do an overview this morning and give you a chance to ask any questions, and then we'll do a meditation. It's a really nice meditation on the Buddha, but it's like the experiential aspect of these three principal aspects of the path put together into a practice. So it gives it a lot of depth, actually, having done this course. So we'll be able to do that as well. So I think what we might do is actually set our motivation for the day, for today's class and also for the rest of the day, so we can think why we're here. And I always like to start setting the motivation by start where you are. So whatever was the make or break reason that you got you here to class this morning, that got you through the technological challenges, that got you out of bed, or at least sitting up in bed on a cold winter's day. So there must have been something that had enough importance to you to bring you to the class this morning. So that's a really good place to start. So bring that to mind. It might be for oneself. It might be for others. There might be someone else that you have in mind also that you wish to be able to help, or a situation or an issue that you need to resolve. So all of those things. And I find it's worth bringing those more personal things to mind to start with, because they have a real emotional weight to them, or an emotional momentum that we immediately relate to. But it's important that we don't just leave it there, because otherwise our practice will kind of degenerate and lose steam. It's why we kind of go up and down so much. So what we do once we've got this initial motivation is we expand it out or adjust our motivation. So the way to adjust our motivation is to try and make it altruistic, meaning including everybody. So just like the people that I care about are suffering and don't want to suffer, so is everybody else. So just like I want to be able to help them, then I can kind of extrapolate out that also, of course, if I knew all the others, I'd want to help them as well. So we include everybody's benefit. Just like we ourselves have problems and questions, so do others. So we're going to do the class on behalf of everybody, and that the benefit can be for us and then spread out like ripples on a pond, that it doesn't just stop with us, but that if we ourselves become kinder and wiser people, we can actually create harmony in the world. And from a Buddhist point of view, we don't even have to just leave it there, but by these small steps now, we can put in place all the causes to become awakened or enlightened, a Buddha, so that we can perfectly help others. So all of that can start right here with us today. So adjusting our motivation like that. And we can do a little breathing meditation as well. Just to settle and balance the mind. So first, think of all the people that know and love you, how they care for you. And imagine that that kindness and care that they have for you as like a bubble of light that you're in, or an aura of light around you. Then also bring to mind the love of all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas who continuously work for sentient beings, for their benefit, to help them. Their whole purpose is to help us. So imagine all of that loving kindness and care manifesting is light surrounding you, enveloping you. All the care of people like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Geshe Zopa, all of our amazing teachers, how every ounce of their being is concerned for our welfare and how much effort they put into our well-being. So think of all of that love and care and effort as light surrounding you. So all of that care and love and wisdom is there all the time, but feel it become manifest now as light. And then imagine that you're breathing in through your left nostril and out through your right. And as you breathe in all of this love and wisdom and care. And the light flows in through your left nostril and it fills up your body. And as you breathe out through the right nostril, the light pushes out all of the inner darkness, all of the disturbing emotions and the depression. So three long, leisurely breaths. And when you've completed the first three breaths, then the next three breaths, swap the nostrils over, this time imagining that you're breathing in through the right nostril, all of this loving kindness and wisdom and all of the strengths and abilities of enlightenment, and this golden radiance fills your body with golden light energy. And it's so powerful and strong that as you breathe out through the left nostril, it pushes out all of that inner darkness, anxieties and doubts, unhappiness, all of the overwhelming, disturbing emotions. They're pushed out in the form of black smoke and you breathe them out through the left nostril, just like releasing pollution. So again, three long, leisurely breaths. And then for the final three rounds, breathing in through both nostrils, all that golden radiance that energizes your whole body, that fills up every atom of your body so it becomes glowing. And as you breathe out through both nostrils, feel that you breathe out even the very subtle negativities, all of those recalcitrant bad habits and tendencies, all the inner saboteurs, all the confusion, completely breathe it out. And feel that the black smoke begins to grow thinner as the negativities become more subtle and we're able to breathe out every single one of them. So again, three long, leisurely breaths. Now that your body is filled with light energy, your mind clear, just for a couple of moments, breathing in and out, radiant clarity. And recalling our motivation to be able to accomplish our own purpose, liberation from suffering and the ups and downs of cyclic existence, and to accomplish a purpose of others, to bring all others out of suffering and into happiness. And then with this clarity of mind, then you can open your eyes if they're closed. So that meditation is a really good way to focus and settle our mind. Really good to do before anything, before you leave the house to go to work, before you start a new project, all of those things. It works on many levels. Psychologically, it reminds us that we are surrounded by support and love and care. We just have to remember to ask. And also neurologically, it balances out our nervous system. So it's got multiple layers to it. Helps us focus and concentrate, which is always a good thing. All right. So what we've been doing in this course is going through what are called the three principal aspects of the path. And I thought I'd just I've got multiple screen shares for us today. I get the first one up to show you, because the course is called How Does Buddhism Help? And what we've been looking at is how we have these, all of the Buddha's teachings are condensed into three bite-sized chunks that we can use and start applying. So really good for beginners. And they are talked about in some very short verses written by Lama Tsongkhapa. And what they show is about reality, self, and others. And so the three principal aspects: renunciation, bodhicitta, and correct view. So the reality, that's the correct view. The work for oneself, that's renunciation. The work for others, bodhicitta. And we need all three if we want to achieve our own happiness and peace of mind, and if we want to live in a peaceful, safe, harmonious world. And if we actually want to alleviate not just the day-to-day suffering, but all suffering and all of its causes, we need all three to work together. For our own happiness, to help those that we love, and to solve global problems, we need all three in balance. So the renunciation one, if we start with that, renunciation, the wish to become free of the cycle of suffering and dissatisfaction, free of the cyclic existence. You might have heard the word samsara, free of samsara. So renunciation, one of the ways that it's translated is definite emergence, meaning to emerge from all of the problems and the muck of samsara, of cyclic existence. And it's depicted as a lotus flower. This is a great metaphor because a lotus flower grows from the mud, grows from the muck and the mud, but it arises unstained and strong, completely pure. So lotus flowers are all over Buddhist symbolism for this very reason, because they represent the innate purity of the mind, that our mind cannot be broken. It is naturally pure, naturally clean, clear. It may be covered in mud at the moment, but that mud isn't an integral part of the mind. is what's called adventitious. All of those disturbing emotions are adventitious, meaning that they come and they go. They're not there all the time, thank goodness. You know, we're not really angry or really resentful all the time. There's a little bit of respite. And so in those times, those windows of opportunity, we can do something about it. So every time you see a lotus, you can remember, the natural purity of my mind. And because the nature of my mind, the nature of our mind is pure and clean and clear, then we can purify it. It is possible to remove all of the disturbing emotions, which are, which complicate our life so much. It's possible to become free from this cycle of dissatisfaction. So renunciation is very much about the work for oneself, one's own kind of goals, one's own wish for liberation, complete freedom, complete emotional freedom and clarity. And so, Lou, do you remember when we were in this class with renunciation, there was that incredible story about the moth to the flame and how even though all of us renounce suffering, no one wants to suffer, we still so often run headlong into it because we don't recognize what the causes of suffering are. And that analogy of the moth, you know, so the moth thinks, the beautiful flame, if I just get that flame, I'll be happy, and has no conception about all the rest of the story of what's in that flame, which will harm them. And then it's a complete shock and it's devastating when they actually get it and then they die. So we're like this all the time, like a moth to the flame of all of the distractions within cyclic existence. And we don't, because we don't recognize what the actual causes of happiness are. And we think our happiness comes from out there. So renunciation is very much renouncing that flame, renouncing all of the outcraving and grasping towards external objects that just bring a whole lot of catastrophe with them. The wish to become free of the cycle of suffering and dissatisfaction. All right, so then bodhicitta was the next one, which is the compassion that is unbiased, so without fear or favor, and it takes, it's also, compassion is an activity, so it takes responsibility for others. And bodhicitta is this extraordinarily big-hearted attitude, and it's a thought, I really want to help every single living being out of suffering because they don't want to suffer just like I don't. And because they feel, because they have feelings, they matter just like me. So we have this enormous big-hearted attitude wanting to help all living beings. And then we kind of think, well, gee whiz, what can I do at the moment? It's really limited what I can do. And so we come to this conclusion, there's nothing else for it, but I've got to become a Buddha. I've got to become enlightened. And that way I'll be able to perfectly help everybody. So bodhicitta is this wish to become a Buddha so that we can help every single living being in the most perfect, most appropriate way that can help each one out of suffering and into a state of lasting peace. So it's an amazing attitude. And if what we do during our day-to-day life is informed by this attitude, then everything that we do becomes beneficial. Then it doesn't matter, you know, if we might be able to save the world by developing a vaccine. We might just, you know, be a cleaner or a stay-at-home parent or a taxi driver or something. But if we do it with a bodhicitta attitude, then the power of that lasts all the way to enlightenment and until everybody is enlightened. It becomes incredibly meaningful, and we get a lot more energy. Everything that we do turns out well in the long term. So it's really the most amazing attitude to have. And compassion is based on equanimity. Bodhicitta is based on equanimity. And it's different from, so in this case, bodhicitta is based on great compassion. And so, you know, great compassion is different from what we call ordinary or mere compassion. Because great compassion includes everybody, whereas normally our ordinary compassion, when it arises, it just arises in response to recognizing suffering. But it's quite biased. It's got favoritism. We feel compassion for one group of people and not another group of people. For instance, we can feel compassion for our family and loved ones, but it's very difficult to feel warm-hearted towards politicians, right? And or towards whatever group of people you want to name. I mean, who knows? He might be a politician. I don't know. But there's always a group of people that we don't necessarily feel compassionate or warmly towards. And that means that we've left the door open for violence, for aggression. So whilst our compassion is biased in some way, then there's always a bunch of people that we're going to harm, and that always creates more harm. Then there's retaliation. And I mean, this is basically how wars start and are perpetuated, because people are defending the ones that they love to the extent that they're going to give up their life. But their willingness for that is very biased and one-sided. It's just for me and mine. And it does not take into consideration the people on the other side who are just like me. So then your compassion turns into violence. So I look at the news about wars around the world and I go, how can they do that? And yet it's what we all do, but just not on such a big scale. And this is how come we end up with wars, because of this bias that we have, because we just have ordinary compassion or ordinary love. So bodhicitta is one that is unbiased, that takes everybody into consideration. Like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, you know, he's probably the world's most famous homeless person, dispossessed, lost his country and his homeland. And when he talks about autonomy for Tibet, he also talks about the well-being of the Chinese people. He never talks about it, even despite everything that's happened, never talks about the Tibetans and the Chinese being opposed. And even when he talks about the Chinese, he doesn't say all of them. He says the Chinese government or the Chinese army, the function of it. But the Chinese people, he cares about their well-being as much as the Tibetan people. So that is amazing. So it's a really long-term approach, isn't it? That if you want the best for the Tibetan people, you also need to have the best for the Chinese people. It can't be an either or. All right, so bodhicitta, huge. But if we have this bodhicitta attitude, then everything that we do will turn out well. And the other thing about the compassion part is that compassion is a lot more than just empathy. Compassion is has this built into it, an activity or taking responsibility. So we're not just feeling for somebody, but we're also thinking, because I see this and recognize it, I have to do something. And from a Buddhist point of view, straight away we can start doing something, which is by developing this intention to help, making it so deep and instinctual. May they be free of suffering. May they have everything that they need. All of them. The person in that car, the person in that car, the person in that checkout, the person in that checkout. And so you turn that into an activity of the mind, so that then whenever there's an opportunity to help, you just automatically do. You don't kind of go, "Whoa, should I do anything or not?" You're just there. Whatever you can do, you naturally do it. So Bodhicitta then is depicted as a moon, like the cooling rays of the moon that cool all of our disturbing emotions. And the analogy goes on because, you know, the moon, how it gets its light is from the sun, isn't it? It's reflected. And so how Bodhicitta gets its power is from the next one, correct view, which is wisdom. So it's actually wisdom that encompasses everything, that holds everything. Just like the sun gives life to everything. Again, without fear or favor. And the sun, how it dispels the darkness of ignorance or the confusion. With the sunlight, when the sun shines, it's not like it chases the darkness away. The darkness is still there and it runs away or it goes out the window. When you bring light to anywhere, the darkness just disappears. So with wisdom, when we bring wisdom to ourselves, to our situations, then the confusion disappears. So the correct view, wisdom, understanding reality or interdependence. So there's always, there's two sides to the correct view. One is the ultimate and one is the relative. And the ultimate view, understanding, so let's do the relative first. The relative, that everything's interdependent. Nothing exists in a vacuum. We are all product of our history, our culture, our circumstances, our karma, our friends and relatives, and then our emotional baggage. And then we bring all of that to a situation and that flavors what that situation is. So it shows this interdependence also shows this is the way we can change things. And if we really understand interdependence, then it shows the ultimate nature of things, which is the lack of inherent existence. And so if we can develop this wisdom, then we kind of move from dogma or belief to actual real understanding, direct perception, being completely in step with reality. And so then that necessarily brings happiness, that necessarily recognizes how we're all interdependent in this world. We're not an island unto ourselves with the coronavirus that's here now. You know, what we do affects everybody else. And we can also see how that wisdom, recognizing that, then plays into bodhicitta. So if we want to be healthy, we need to have universal health care. If we want to be healthy, we need everybody else to be healthy. So the wisdom kind of supports then the compassion. So that's the overview. Now tell me, what questions, comments, anything that stood out to you about these three principal aspects? Or anything that you'd like clarified?
I really thought the session on compassion and empathy was really good because I find people don't understand the difference between those.
Yeah, that's right. So when I first heard it, because it's using contemporary Western terms, which I kind of relate to. So I hadn't actually heard it spelt out like that till Corey Jackson came and talked about it, using these neuroscience terms. The empathy that we have and the two types of empathy. So, Lou, do you remember those two types?
I'd have to look at my paper.
One of them is Affective empathy. So that's where we feel for somebody.
That's right. Very
Often people talk about it as mirror neurons. So if someone's crying, you know, everyone's crying at a wedding, then you start crying. Or if someone's spewing, then you start feeling a bit spewy.
Okay.
Or if you're seeing a distressing situation, then you also become incredibly distressed. So often, like when we see animal torture, we feel so much for them that we also become incredibly distressed. So that's the affective empathy. And normally when we talk about empathy, that's what we assume that we mean. And also that's what we assume compassion is, but that's not, that's the first step of compassion, but it's not yet compassion. That's just feeling for somebody. Mm. And if that's all we can do, that's right. It's like we will get burnt out. So normally our only response to this, you know, for first responders, ambulance, nurses, everything like that, is just to emotionally shut down, to stop feeling that empathy. So that's not so good, is it? Because that cuts off this whole spectrum of your humanity. So from a Buddhist point of view, that what we do is we use that affective empathy, that feeling for others, and we develop it into compassion, which is an activity of the mind that goes, may you be free of suffering. I will try and help you become free of suffering. What can I do? And the moment we do that, we have something to do, even if it's just a wish. And we go from hopelessness and help, well, being helpless first, you know, we have empathy. If we don't do anything, we feel helpless. And if we can't do anything, then we feel hopeless. And then comes either despair or cynicism or becoming jaded. So we use that that feeling to develop compassion, this wish that the others be free of suffering, and a sense of kind of care and responsibility that just for the fact that we're there, we have to do something about it. So that gives us back our agency, our power. We can meditate on not just, oh, how terrible the suffering is, but I wish you were free of it. I wish you everything that you need. I wish you all the peace in the world. I wish you free of all the causes of suffering. So then it's not so debilitating. But there was that other type of empathy too, remember? Which is cognitive empathy, where we work it out. So that's the one where we try and put ourselves in someone else's shoes. And if you're a doctor or a teacher, for instance, you use this a lot because you put yourself into the shoes of the patient or the student without being as overwhelmed as they are. So it's like if the doctor just had affective empathy, then they would be as sick as the patient or as depressed as the patient. So the doctor has to have the other type of understanding, but not being emotionally overwhelmed, but really understanding all the nuances that perhaps the person experiencing it doesn't, because they're just overwhelmed by all their feelings. So cognitive empathy, really, really important. And many times people who have cognitive empathy are accused of being cold-hearted because they, you know, they're not expressing, emotively expressing, they're just thinking it through.
I was listening to a podcast, and it probably goes back to where all this sort of thinking started. They were talking to first response, you know, that police from the 70s and stuff like that, and they were saying to them, well, how did you, you know, that you, did you have debriefing? And they went, oh yeah, we went to the pub on Friday night, sort of thing. And then they said when they did look at bringing it in, they had to then look for people specialized in the area because there weren't counselors that could actually effectively counsel them, because they were doing that, they were putting themselves in the position, they didn't have any resources that they could draw on to actually help them. So that must have been all sort of started, that they were looking at the different ways of how they could now help them. And they're saying even now there are, you know, like they're recommended to people who specialise in that area, not just to any sort of counsellor, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, and I think, Lou, that's because people who specialise in an area have developed that affective empathy, so they understand, and then they can lead it into the activity of compassion. So even, you know, with being debriefed on whatever situation, it leads you into the activity of, well, what can we do to make the situation go better next time? You know, how can we be proactive here to head things off at the pass? So there are all these things to do. So your feeling about the situation translates into action. And so, of course, only like experienced counsellors that know about the situation. You know, like for instance, with racism, when there's a racial incident. And so, you know, if people are lucky enough to get counselling, you need to have someone that understands all the workings of racism to be able to move you through it. So then the kind of the cognitive empathy then helps to lead us to compassion. But I am continuously shocked by these, you know, people who work on the front lines, like even in the army, there's no debriefing when you come back from this extreme situation for months and months and months. There's nothing, maybe half an hour or something.
And I think we're better than Americans, because you hear of so many of the Americans are actually homeless and living on the streets.
That's right. So then they don't even have any, it's like as if they've come out of jail, you know, no support. So to expect people to go through such an extreme situation and not have any debriefing, it really, in one way it does show the resilience of the human spirit. To be able to just survive that is extraordinary. And then just naturally, I mean, this isn't just a theory, but you see that the people who do survive traumatic situations are the ones that they've let it change their life, and they've started up a self-help group, or they've started a movement of feeding the poor, or they've actually translated it into activity. And even though it might be a really small section of society that they're able to help, it changes everything, doesn't it? And it turns you from being overwhelmingly depressed and hopeless to at least having something to do. So that's kind of the natural trajectory, and it's why we need to have that the wisdom supporting the compassion.
My girlfriend, who's, I might point out, was brought up in South Africa, and her daughter wanted to go and march in the Black Lives Matter, and she you know, she's just turned 18 and in year 12, and Marina was saying to her, you know, you're not going in a march. One day doesn't make a difference. What are you going to do about it? Marches are dangerous. And her daughter turned around and told her she was a privileged white woman, which I thought was very brave, coming from somebody who grew up in South Africa during apartheid. And the reason they left was because it actually has gotten worse since apartheid has gone. And Marina just went, well, no, because I'm trying to get through to you that one day will not make a difference. You getting arrested or you getting hurt or others getting hurt won't make a difference. Yeah. And she said, if you're actually listening to some of the Aboriginal elders, they're actually saying, we don't want you to do it for one day. We're doing it systematically and quietly with the government, and we need that support. We don't just want you there on one day.
And trying to get teenagers that
it's the next step to that. If it does matter, then show it somehow physically and actively, rather than just that.
That's one. Right. It's the first step. It's not, okay, I've done my bit and now I'm not doing anymore. So, I mean, really, I did see how having that many people come out and demonstrate really did literally demonstrate, hey, this matters and times are changing now. So that's really important. But, yeah, it has to be translated into action, and often we just go and demonstrate to make our own conscience feel better. And then we just relax and we forget about actually how are we going to help these people, especially us from, you know, me, position of privilege, how am I going to help? So, and if we don't, then it really gnaws away as fear and anxiety in the background there. So, one of the other things too that I wanted to illustrate about this, why we need to have wisdom, is Lama Yeshe often talked about we've got to be careful that we don't have idiot compassion. And I mean, it's quite a confronting term to say idiot compassion. But with this coronavirus, there was one example there where there were some footballers that wanted to go back and see their mates somewhere, you know, in the country to show them some emotional support. And this is where they'd shut down the Northern Territory to keep the Indigenous population safe. And so these footballers kind of broke ranks and went off and saw their bros to give emotional support. So that right there is the affective empathy of feeling for them with zero wisdom, you know, because by them actually visiting them, they could be bringing them death. They could have all had the virus, sat around the campfire together, and brought the virus right into the community that they were feeling for. And I mean, this has happened several times. Like people have, they just want to go see their loved ones and give them a hug over and over. And then just think, oh, you know, if we break the rules, if no one sees it, we'll be right. So the effect of empathy, if it's not informed by wisdom, can actually end up being idiot compassion. That, you know, how many people have said, I just want to hug my grandkids. And then we think, oh, if the government has said it's safe to do this, then we'll be safe. So we've externalized it as like the law. And then maybe we can get around the law. And so then the idiot compassion comes in. Instead of just thinking, how am I best going to protect my loved ones? It's by social distancing. And so then you get this thing like that's happening in America where you have people demonstrating against the laws as if the laws are the problem. And again, that comes from the wisdom, the lack of wisdom, where because the law is hampering us from leaving the house or doing whatever, we ascribe inherence to it. And we think the law is what's harming me. And it's a very instinctual kind of response. So therefore, if I demonstrate against the law and get my rights back, everything will be fine. And how come that kind of insanity, how come we get so unhinged from reality is because we ascribe what's called inherence or true existence to the law, to the external things, instead of seeing it as a dependent arising, which is the law is in response to how contagious the virus is. So if you're going to demonstrate, my God, demonstrate against the virus. But you can you see how there's this trajectory that if we don't have the wisdom, then we end up with insanity, demonstrating against stay-at-home laws. You know, and so then who knows what's going to happen with, I mean, the virus trajectory in America is just going up, 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 up because of that.
I'll have to remember that. I quite like that idiot compassion.
Yeah, just careful. Don't fling the word around too much, all right?
No, I'll just think it in my head.
But so many times it's like, you know, when we just have an emotive feeling and we try and give comfort, but it may not be the wise thing to do. The comfort is there, but it's not going to actually solve the problem. It's like going to the demonstration. It's kind of demonstrating our goodwill, but it doesn't actually solve the problem. So we really need to employ our wisdom and our affective empathy, and that will help. And then, so always in the Buddhist philosophy and practice, it's wisdom that supports our compassion. Whereas you know, in the West, we have a slightly different kind of approach, don't we? For one, compassion is seen as an optional extra. But we see how that's backfired with, if we don't have universal health care, it backfires on an individual. Or if we don't have a basic living wage for everybody, it backfires on an entire economy. So it's kind of even in our best interests to look after others. So that was this other wonderful term. Remember His Holiness the Dalai Lama calling it intelligent selfishness. So if we want to be as happy and as wealthy and as safe as we want, we have to make sure everybody else is, or we cannot live in safety. We cannot live, we won't, you know, we'll be living in fear of our lives if we're not looking after everyone around us. So it's really quite simple. So again, we're using our wisdom to work that one out. Intelligent selfishness, long-term, if we want long-term happiness, absolutely have to include everybody else in there. So, Sam, have you got any questions? I know you haven't necessarily been to the other classes, so I hope this is making some sense for you. You can always put something in the chat if you want as well. That's okay. So Lama Yeshe, this is from this book that I've been reading from, The Essence of Tibetan Buddhism. And Lama Yeshe says, sometimes it might look complicated when we present the three principal paths to enlightenment in the Tibetan way, but actually they're very simple. When you're contemplating and a thought arises, move from that thought and practice renunciation, so letting go. When another thought comes along, move from that and practice bodhicitta, warm-heartedness. And then go back and contemplate the clarity of your own consciousness. That's easy. You're just moving your mind into renunciation, bodhicitta, and wisdom. You're doing well, you're making your life worthwhile. So one of the examples for doing this is when we're trying to meditate and focus our mind, say for instance, just on the breathing meditation, even something really simple. So we're trying to clear and focus our mind, developing our concentration and then being able to develop our wisdom. And if we can do that, then when the thoughts or the distractions arise, with our renunciation, we can let them go. We're not sucked into them. And with the bodhicitta, when we're distracted, we can practice so that instead of going, oh, and getting frustrated, every time we get distracted, we can think, wow, just like I'm getting distracted, so does everybody else. No one has control of their minds. We're all pushed around by our disturbing emotions, and we use that experience of distraction to generate compassion, to just recognize, wow, this is the nature of my mind, you know, where it's got all these adventitious disturbing emotions jumping around and I can't even focus on whatever I want to focus on, you know, this constant state of suffering and dissatisfaction. How, you know, feel compassion for yourself, feel compassion for others. So I found this really amazing, that instead of just getting frustrated in meditation, that if you're just sitting down and having a terrible meditation and you can't concentrate, you can use it as an opportunity to develop your compassion, to just go, wow, you know, poor me, poor others. And then that way your mind can relax a little bit, and then you can bring it back and get back to the job of the meditation. So each way, whatever happens, we can developing these three principal aspects: our wisdom and concentration, our renunciation, letting go of all the worldly concerns and the craving, grasping, and me, and developing our compassion and our love, our bodhicitta, in response to all of those problems. So just by just trying to focus on a breathing meditation, we can be doing all this really profound work in the background, and that primes our mind for when we go out into the world. Oh, great. So you can hear Sam. Very pleased to hear. Glad you're enjoying it. That's okay. You can always just type stuff in. That's fine. So we've got reality, self, and others, and they're inextricably linked, aren't they? So let's have a look at if we can develop these three, how amazing it is. Here's our next one. So if we can develop renunciation, which is letting go of our immediate concerns, usually just to do with the comforts of this life, so that we can actually focus on the things that really matter. So that means having less expectations, trying to have less stuff, not worrying so much about status or ambition, all of these acknowledgements from outside, but looking within. So the moment we start doing that, we're automatically less stressed. So many times we think we're stressed because of the job or because what's happening in the world at the moment. But that's not the cause of our stress. The cause of our stress is the mind that we bring to naturally changeable situations, because we can go from one job to another and we just take our stress with us. So actually, to be less stressed means letting go of those expectations, letting go of our craving for external validation, letting go of our disturbing emotions, our resentments, letting go of our fears of failure. So if we do that, then naturally we become less stressed. We'll have a natural curiosity. Instead of being intimidated, we'll be naturally curious. And we won't waste our time on all of the fickle, stupid things that we normally do, but actually be able to spend time on the things that count, that matter to us. So we'll be able to live an authentic life, true to our values, with natural courage and joyousness. So one of the things about this COVID-19 whole experience is that it really showed what mattered and what didn't. So a whole lot of stuff that happened at work, you know, suddenly didn't matter anymore. It was much more life and death situation. And people, you know, found that spending time doing less stuff, being less busy, was a real like a holiday for the mind. So often we think renunciation means we're not going to have as much fun, or at least that's what I thought. But actually, with renunciation, we can enjoy what we have much more. So if we have developed a sense of renunciation in our mind, then being on lockdown is actually a huge relief. But if we don't have renunciation in our mind, then we just feel like we're being deprived of everything. So, you know, it's the same situation, but whether we get to enjoy it depends on if we have renunciation or not. So it's quite a different approach from our normal approach, which before COVID was just go out and entertain yourself as much as possible. Distract yourself as much as possible. Travel and do this and do that and, you know, busy, 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 busy. Go here, there, everywhere, all these appointments. And then suddenly not having to do any of that, people were quite surprised at how much they relished the solitude. So, of course, if we don't then do that inner work, then the restlessness comes up again. And so now everyone's sick of it. Everyone's sick of isolation. And so they just, like how social distancing's pretty much gone out the window, as you would have found, Lou, working in a shopping centre, you know, it's because people are just sick of it. We're restless and we're still looking for things outside of us. So we've gotten used to the situation now of being at home and now we're over it. Now we want to go out again. And to the extent that people are like, I'm just going to ignore it. I'm over it. I'm just going to demonstrate against, you know, the lockdown laws. I want to do what I want to do. So that restlessness comes up again. So this is why we need more than just renunciation. We have to actually look at what's the cause of that restlessness. With bodhicitta, this attitude, so the great compassion, the compassion for everybody, the victims and the oppressors, care for everybody, wanting the well-being for my loved ones as well as for everybody else, including all the people I don't necessarily like, you know, people in jail or, you know, criminals, and they also need to have well-being and safety for me to be able to be safe. And they also need happiness as much as I do. So we develop this attitude, this big-hearted attitude based on equanimity. And then if we have that attitude, then we'll be able to help according to our capacity. And that means we won't burn out, because burnout comes when we start focusing on the external activity only. And so we feel, if I can't physically save somebody, then I can't do anything. Or like with coronavirus at the moment, we feel like if we can't hug our family members, we cannot express our love. But this is completely wrong. This is how our initial motivation or intentions, which are in our heart, we've externalized them. And so we think that love is where we can physically express our love by, say, hugging our granny or hugging our grandkids. And if we can't, we feel we can't love. And we've forgotten that love is actually what's happening in our mind, in our heart. It's an intention, a wish. And that we can keep on doing, even if we are locked in our own house for months and months and months and never get to see anybody. We can still express our love and our care and our concern by this practice of great compassion, great care, bodhicitta. So I found this a really good, it's almost like a litmus test, isn't it? That if you start feeling, oh, you know, I'm really missing people and I just want to, you know, see my friends and give them a great big hug, already we've slipped into externalizing things and we've lost touch of the main part of it, which is intention. So it's a really good, like, warning bells. And if we use that to come back again to the main practice of bodhicitta is within our mind, is our intention, that activity of becoming so familiar with the thought, may you be free of suffering and all of its causes, may you be have happiness and all of its causes, may I be the one to help in whatever way possible, then whenever you can help, you're overjoyed to do so. And when you can't, it's okay because you're still practicing. Then you will never burn out. You'll never get despondent. It won't matter if anyone thanks you or not. you won't lose hope or get cynical or jaded. You know, you'll keep your energy for the long term. It's really amazing. And if we have correct view, then even in the coronavirus lockdown, we still feel connected. So that kind of happened, didn't it? You know, especially at the beginning, where everyone was saying we're all in this together. And even though we're all locked in our own houses, and especially all the news reports, you know, I was seeing in Italy that there was this incredibly strong connection as a society, a recognition that we're all going through this experience together, even though we're not physically together. And that made people feel good instead of alienated. It was quite different, wasn't it? So it really helped bring the reality to mind that we are actually all the time connected, intimately connected, but we just don't recognize it. How can we feel lonely and alienated when we are interdependent with everybody and everything? It's not in step with reality, and yet we do feel lonely and alienated. It's because we don't have this correct view. We don't recognize that interconnectedness. And on a not so personal level, but, you know, with saving the planet, I mean, this is how come the planet, while we have global warming and pollution and all of those things, because we have ignored the interconnectedness. We've ignored cause and effect. No one set out to make lots and lots of money and pollute the environment. It just happened as a byproduct because we're just focusing on just me and mine. So again, you can see how bodhicitta and equanimity comes into it, because if we just focus on me, on mine, and hang the rest, we end up with a polluted planet where no one can breathe. So the correct view, again, is so incredibly important. It also means that we can find many ways to look at a situation. So again, the coronavirus experience for us in a very fortunate country like Australia, we can find so many opportunities within this experience. So what was the other thing? Here's a little bit from Lama Yeshe about equanimity, or equilibrium, as Lama Yeshe called it. So remember equilibrium? Equilibrium doesn't mean I equalize you externally. If that were so, you'd have to come to Nepal and eat only rice and dal. Equilibrium is not to do with the object. It's to do with the subject, my business. My two extreme minds, desire, the overestimated view and grabbing, and hatred, the underestimated view and rejecting. These two conflict, destroying my own peace, happiness, and loving kindness. In order to balance those two, I have to equalize equilibrium. So just this point about equilibrium or equanimity, it's not about equalizing out there. Again, it's just like loving kindness and care and compassion isn't so much about what you do out there. It has to start within our mind. And it means equalizing the extreme minds that we have of extreme attachment or extreme aversion. The minute your fanatical view and grasping start, the reaction of hatred has already arrived. They come together. I think you've experienced this. We do have this experience. The minute something becomes special for you, breaks your heart, in that minute, the opposite mind of hatred has come. They are interdependent phenomena. For some reason, by having an ego, the tendency is always to be unbalanced, extreme. We have so many problems, individual, personal problems, and they all come from the extreme mind. The thing is, why, for instance, don't we have a good meditation? Simply, why can't we concentrate? We can't concentrate even for a minute because our extreme mind explodes. Internally, there's a nuclear blow up. We're out of control. We should learn how to handle that explosion. First of all, the problem is not something that's happened by accident. We should know that there's an evolution to its existence. Therefore, our first order of business should be to investigate the extreme view of our ego mind. So I think the key here, you know, what Lamyeshi is saying, the minute your fanatical view and grasping start of wanting something, the reaction of hatred has already arrived. They come together. It's so true, isn't it? So the moment we have grasping and craving, wanting something, in that moment of wanting to possess something or have it, to get this thing from outside of us, in that moment is also born the mind of hatred, because anyone who thwarts it, we cannot bear. And when times are quite stressful, or when we're really thrown on, you know, in extreme situations like this, you know, the coronavirus, for instance, then and the lockdown, then instances of domestic violence have gone up. And this is because we have, it's more in our face. We have more craving. We want our partner to be in a certain way, to give me the satisfaction that I want. We want to be able to, you know, control them. We want to grasp, to have, to be possessive. And in that moment is born hatred, or being unable to bear it be in any other way. And so just with the tiniest little change in circumstances or tiredness or whatever, then you snap, and then suddenly there's hatred towards the loved one. But both of them come together, the extreme grasping and craving, wanting to control and possess. And at first, when that arises, we think that's love, that kind of attachment, but it's not. It's a deluded state of mind attachment, nothing to do with love. And why, we can tell when it flips and it turns to hatred and retaliation. So, you know, for that reason, that kind of situation, which is expressed in the horrendous domestic violence rate that we have in Australia, like Lamyeshi says, it has an evolution. It comes from somewhere. And so where it comes from is the deluded mind and the lack of renunciation. So the deluded mind of expecting our happiness to come from out there, and then, you know, all of the craving and grasping more and more, better and better. And it just actually gets worse and worse. So to overcome all of these things, we need to educate ourselves and others in these three principal aspects: renunciation, bodhicitta, and correct view. And if we do, we can actually then remedy the evolution of that situation. It can't just come from legislation. That's like the first step, actually, you know, recognizing the problem as and giving it its due. But we need education way, way earlier, what to do about craving and grasping, what to do about looking for our happiness out there and thinking, you are the cause of my happiness and you are the cause of my unhappiness, so I'm going to destroy you. So this is where we really need to educate ourselves, educate our children before they turn into adults that don't know any better, and that you know, have such power that they can actually, you know, do these things. And it's also why we need to have equilibrium, that we don't just end up hating the aggressors or the oppressors. And Eddie said this thing last week that I found very useful, was to be able to look underneath the behavior to the suffering. So it doesn't mean condoning the behavior, no, but it means our response to something like domestic violence isn't hatred. It can't be hatred. We can't alienate those aggressors even more, because actually all of us could end up being an aggressor. It's not like bad people create domestic violence. It's like anybody can create domestic violence if they're not educated about what to do with our emotions. So we can't, you know, having a hatred response, it won't help. We have to be able to get underneath to where that suffering is and then bring our wisdom to it. So I know I got off on a bit of a tangent, but, you know, I just, you know, read the news about yet another domestic violence case. You know, a husband who killed his wife in front of the children. So that kind of thing comes from not understanding how our mind works, how emotions work, where happiness comes from, where suffering comes from. We end up with such extreme results like this that it's just a tragedy all round. So what I would like to do is a meditation now. Let's put this into a practice. So we've, you know, I've been talking about compassion and loving kindness being an activity, not just empathy, but an activity. So how do we do that? We do it by practicing in our mind in meditation. It's like a flight simulator or a rehearsal. You have to rehearse it as a practice until it becomes second nature. So let's do the rehearsal for life. So I've put up here in the screen share a picture of Shakyamuni Buddha and then the mantra of Shakyamuni Buddha, which we can recite when we get to it. And the meditation, it's very nice. So you can either do it in your mind, close your eyes and try and imagine, and then when you get into difficulty or a little bit fatigued about that, then you can open your eyes again and look at the picture to remind you, and then close your eyes again and try and bring it as an internal experience. So we can kind of alternate like that using the picture. The other thing to remember about the picture of Shakyamuni Buddha is that it's a lot more than like an old-fashioned photo. It's actually a story. It's like an experiential way of putting all the dot points about the path to enlightenment. All of the Tibetan iconography is a story. It tells, it incorporates all the points of the path, including the three principal aspects. So it's a way of relating to it in a way that's not just theoretical. It's not just academic dot points like we have in our notes, but we're relating to it experientially as well. So it brings it much, much deeper into our experience, and it means it will change our automatic responses and even our instinctual responses. So let's do this meditation. Nice deep breath. Settle your posture and relax your mind. And think that you are sitting here doing meditation with everybody that you know and love. Also surrounded by all the strangers, everybody here in Brisbane, and then, you know, the rest of the world, including the politicians and the other people that we don't necessarily like. And we're all doing this meditation together because we all need happiness and none of us wants to be miserable. And then think that in the sky in front of you, arising out of clarity, gradually arises Shakyamuni Buddha. So in your mind's eye, first, what you can start seeing in this light and clarity is a square golden throne supported by eight white snow lions two at each corner. So as we're looking at this beautiful golden throne, we can think of it as this is like a foundation stone for our whole spiritual path. And it has steps leading up to it. They're the steps along the path. It has four different kind of levels, and they represent the four immeasurable thoughts. And it's beautified with all sorts of jewels and filigree. And all of those jewels, they're like the realizations that you have along the path to enlightenment that beautify your journey. And the eight white snow lions that are holding up the throne, they represent the eight great bodhisattvas, incredibly strong, courageous, the courageous-hearted attitude of bodhicitta. And that's what supports our spiritual path, literally. Now, on this throne arises a beautiful lotus flower. So you can imagine it as like a pink lotus that comes out of the mud, or a pristine white lotus, or a multicolored lotus. But nevertheless, remember what the lotus represents, the natural purity of your mind. It doesn't matter how much dirt and muck there is, the lotus flower actually repels dirt. So arising out of the natural purity of your mind, then within this lotus flower are two cushions. One made of a sun disc or a sun bed, and the other a moon disc, a moon cushion. So the sun cushion represents correct view, that wisdom, realizing the ultimate nature of reality, that wisdom that clears away all confusion and darkness. And on this, it's supporting the moon disc, which is bodhicitta, the great compassion, great love for all living beings without fear or favoritism. So those two are born out of our clean, clear, perfect mind. And the wisdom supports the bodhicitta. The lotus, the sun, and the moon disc, they represent those three principal aspects of the path. And they are literally the seat of enlightenment, what enlightenment is based on. So on these arises Shakyamuni Buddha, golden and radiant, a body made of light particles, not flesh and blood, so it can't degenerate. But very much alive, lively, looking at you and very pleased that you're here. And Shakyamuni Buddha, in the beginning, was just like us, had problems and family and stresses, had a fairly charmed existence, and wondered, was there anything more? And the difference between Shakyamuni Buddha and us is that Shakyamuni Buddha traveled along the spiritual path and liberated his mind from all the causes of suffering and developed all of his qualities. And if we do that, we can too end up like Shakyamuni Buddha, fully enlightened. So when we gaze at Shakyamuni Buddha in front of us, we can think, this is a mirror of my own potential. So let your heart open and ask Shakyamuni Buddha for help and guidance along the spiritual path so you too can attain this state, just like he did, and so that you can help everybody surrounding you lead all sentient beings out of suffering and into lasting peace and happiness. You can ask Shakyamuni Buddha to help you with any particular problems that are going on at the moment as well. And from his heart, a blissful white light comes streaming across space and flows down the crown of your head into your body, purifying your body and mind, washing through you like a great waterfall. So keep this experience of the white light flowing down through your crown and completely purifying all negativities, disturbing emotions, suffering and all of its causes, illnesses, everything. Taya ta om mune mune ma munaya soha. Taya ta om mune mune ma munaya soha. Taya ta om mune mune maha munaya soha. Feel your body clean and clear, your mind relaxed, peaceful, perfectly alert. And then again, golden light flows from Shakyamuni Buddha's heart, and this golden light flows into you through your crown, and it spreads through your whole clean, clear body, or your nervous system, illuminating every single atom of your body so it becomes made of light. And as this light flows into you, you receive all of the enlightened qualities of a Buddha, of unlimited perfect compassion, ultimate care and love, wisdom, perfect understanding and knowledge, all flows into you in the form of this golden light and absorbs into you. Taya ta om mune mune maha munaya soha. Taya ta om mune mune maha munaya soha. Taya ta om mune mune maha munaya soha. Feel that you've absorbed all of those enlightened qualities. Your body feels energized, your mind blissful, radiant. You've received everything that you need for yourself and to be able to help others. And then very gradually, Shakyamuni Buddha, there in the space in front of you, begins to dissolve into light. The lions melting into the throne. The throne melting into the lotus. The sun and the moon cushion. Shakyamuni Buddha becoming brighter and brighter. And there's light, a ball of light coming to the crown of your head, hovering there above your crown, and then this light melting into you through your crown. Incredible radiance. And as this light melts into you, your ordinary sense of who you are completely dissolves. And your body and mind become one with enlightened body and mind in the aspect of vast radiant space. And out of this spaciousness, in the place where you are sitting, you arise in the aspect of Shakyamuni Buddha, just as you imagined earlier, on a lotus sun and moon seat, wearing the robes of a Buddha, with a radiant golden body, on the throne supported by the courageous lions. And from your Buddha heart, spontaneously light flows in all directions. You fully see all living beings wherever they are. You understand exactly what they're going through. And spontaneously light flows from your heart to give them everything that they need, to remove all the causes of their suffering. So much so that everyone around you also becomes transformed into Buddhas. And the entire environment becomes peaceful, beautiful, like a pure land. And so this third time, as we recite the mantra, then see those light rays, countless light rays, each one reaching a living being, including those that you know of personally who are experiencing any kind of problem. Tayata om mune mune maha munaya soha. Tayata om mune mune maha munaya soha. Tayata om mune mune maha munaya soha. So feel those light rays emanating from your Buddha heart, as the light rays reach each living being. They are completely purified and filled with bliss. They too transform into a Buddha. And then the light rays absorb back into your heart, which becomes even more radiant and more energized. And then once again, they radiate outwards, purifying sentient beings, bringing them to a state of Buddhahood, and then absorbing back into your heart, which becomes even more radiant. So just like breathing, the way a Buddha breathes, emanating and absorbing lights. And then we can dedicate the efforts of this meditation and our good intentions for today, that by doing this practice, may we actually be able to bring it into reality. May we actually become a Buddha to liberate all sentient beings from suffering and bring them to ultimate happiness. By doing this practice, may it become a reality. And by emanating and absorbing the lights, may this become our activity 24 hours a day, whatever we're doing. And that as we bring peace and happiness to others, we in turn become more energized. Just like breathing, may we never forget our altruistic intention. May we look after others as well as we look after ourselves. And so dedicate all of this to being able to bring about this Buddhahood for oneself and others. So I hope you can see how the three principal aspects then are incorporated into an experience. And we need that experience, because it's not just enough to have intellectual knowledge. We have to change how we are embodied beings, how we go about our life, right down to a very deep level, so that we become trustworthy for ourselves and for others. So it's a lot more than just imagining. If we just had the imagination without any of the background, it's no harm in that. But having the background, say, of this study of the three principal aspects brings a lot of power to that imagination. And then we put it into this practice, and the practice becomes second nature. Then we go about our life, and it'll be amazing. We'll be able to accomplish everything, including that exact meditation. So, look, thank you very much for coming along, and I hope you enjoyed the course. And Sam, good on you. This is a very excellent way to have your first Zoom meeting. Congratulations for getting this far. It's quite an achievement. And I hope to see you again. We're about to go on a two-week mid-year break, but then we'll be back with all of our online classes again in semester two. So, you know, have a look at slowly putting semester two's calendar up there. And then, you know, email me if you've got any questions about any of the other courses.
Thanks, Murphy. I love that meditation.
Oh, you did? Oh, good. Yeah.
And I'm out of bed. It's really good.
So, yeah, Lou, it's been great having you along, my stalwart fan for this course. Really, really great. Yeah. And
yeah, it's been really interesting and good to do.
So I'll send out a little feedback survey. So even if, Sam, even if you've just done one class, that's okay. It's part of the questions on it, but it helps us, you know, to continue developing these courses. And so please stay safe. You know, social isolation is actually practicing non-harm. And really hope to see you again very, very soon. Have a wonderful rest of the day.